Yosef Pieper, In Tune with the World. Chapter 9, the final chapter. C'est la guerre qui correspond à la fête. The modern equivalent of festivals is war. In this provocative sentence, Roger Caillois answers the question of what nowadays takes that place in the life of society which once upon a time was filled by festivals. At first, he says, he imagined that the answer might be vacations. But then he realized that vacations are not only not consonant with festivals, but that they are rather mutually exclusive, and that in the present world it is instead war that fulfills the functions of the great festivals. In war, he says, all the attributes of festivals may be found. He considers festivals as essentially a time of excess. The most drastic conversion and consumption of energies, the eruption of stored force, the merging of the individual in the totality, the squandering of resources ordinarily carefully husbanded, the wild breaking down of inhibitions, and so on. Once we have recovered from the shock that such a statement is meant to inflict upon the reader, once we begin casting about for counter-arguments, we are forced to admit, however much against our will, that the present state of things does seem to favor so extreme a hypothesis. Since the time of Nietzsche, who called himself the destroyer par excellence, and who dreamed of a company of men who would be called destroyers, for almost three generations then, the idea of active nihilism, of the will to nothingness, and pleasure even in destruction, has been part of the modern attitude toward life. And those were all quotations from, oh, they're from Nietzsche. And when someone comments that a myth like that of the Twilight of the Gods, which implies the shattering of the created world, in our time no longer belongs solely to the realm of the imagination, we can scarcely disagree. Even Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, although enthusiastically convinced of the future energy of the cosmos, feels called upon to speak of a dawning organic crisis in evolution which is preparing under our modern disquiet. The last century, he says, witnessed the first systematic strikes in industry. The next will surely not pass without the threat of strikes in the noosphere. Or more precisely, there is a danger that the world should refuse itself when perceiving itself through reflection. This strike has evidently already begun. Darkening of the world, flight of the gods, disintegration of reality, absurdity of existence, nausea, such are the key words heard on every hand, whether in philosophical or literary discussions, whether the subject be the visual arts or music. In the face of this overpowering chorus of naysayers, there seems little point in arguing the matter. They insist that they have been betrayed, and are consequently wiser than the unbetrayed, in Kierkegaard's phrase. He who laughs has not yet received the terrible tidings. Not that the actual state of the world does not offer sufficient grounds for such fatalism. We might remember, for example, that the great teachers of Christendom, who were also far from being conformists who accepted the world as it was. On the contrary, they held that man has so shamefully disgraced the earth and himself, and plunged both into such a deplorable state that return to nothingness, total annihilatio, might well appear an act of justice. Compared with such a view, it is the height of naive optimism to believe that the evil in the world is a matter of specific social systems or dark ages. To be sure, those same teachers also knew that no one is really able to revoke the act of creation except the Creator himself, and that he had created all things so that they might be. I really do not know how an incorruptible mind, faced with the evil in the world, could keep from utter despair were it not for the logically tenable conviction that there is a divinely guaranteed goodness of being which no amount of mischief can undermine. But that is the point of view of the man who sees the world as creatura, not to speak of the believer who is confident of a salvation that infinitely surpasses all creature goodness. Perhaps it is only thanks to such super-empirical certainties that man is able to assume the intellectually and existentially extremely demanding task of facing naked reality without resorting to the evasions either of euphemism or of slander. But of course, what counts is not primarily a matter of intellectual categories, nor the psychological capacity to endure tensions. What counts is truth. And might it not be the truth that the man who despairs, he in particular, has not yet received certain tidings? This is not the place to discuss the arguments of nihilism. Our subject is festivity. But it is self-evident that those negations, as soon as they reach a certain degree of intensity, render true festivity impossible. At the same time, and this seems considerably less self-evident, they pave the way for something else. And the destruction of the world, for example, in the global war of annihilation, is not feared as an unspeakable calamity, but anticipated as something to be desired, even celebrated as ordinarily only affirmations can be. Thus destruction becomes anti-festival, one of those great uprisings which Eisner has described as borrowing the means from war and the mood from festivals. To shut our eyes to this development would mean repressing a whole dimension of reality. Such anti-festive affirmation of negation has to be taken into account. This, too, lies within the nature of man as a historical creature. Nevertheless, I repudiate the hypothesis of war as the modern equivalent of festivals. It is not merely an unpardonable simplification. It is downright wrong. Its greatest error lies in its implying that our present era is devoid of true festivals, and moreover must be so. In reality, festivals are not only possible, but are still being celebrated. However, a sociological and psychological analysis of Western society based on attitudes toward festivity would still bring to light a good many dubious phenomena. Above all, this one, that we would be hard put to find anywhere today the kind of great festival that, springing from the praise of God and ritual worship, includes everybody, permeates all spheres, and puts its stamp on all of public life. On the other hand, the general susceptibility to artificial holidays established by men has risen considerably, even if, as in the case of, say, Mother's Day, there is no background of political coercion. No less dangerous is the susceptibility to quickly available, virtually purchasable surrogates, which convey a counterfeit of the things that can be had only in true festivals: rapture, oblivion of ills, a sense of harmony with the world. Furthermore, most of the traditional holidays of Christendom have become awkward occasions, and a few of the great Christian festivals have been taken over so completely by commercialism that their degeneracy is almost total. In addition, there is the multitude of festivities and parties based on the illusion that no particular occasion is needed for celebrating, just leisure time and a well-lined pocketbook. All this combines in preparing the soil for the noisy pomp of pseudo-festivals to be celebrated at the command of any despotism. And that makes me think, isn't one of the cruise line companies called Festival? That's a case in point. But this is not the whole picture. In this same contemporary world of ours, there remains the indestructible, for otherwise human nature itself would have to be destroyed. The indestructible gift, innate in all men, which impels them now and again to escape from the restricted sphere where they labor for their necessities and provide for their security, to escape not by mere forgetting, but by undeceived recollection of the greater, more real reality. Now, as always, the workaday world can be transcended in poetry and the other arts. In the shattering emotion of love, beyond the delusions of sensuality, men continue to find entrance to the still point of the turning world. Now, as always, the experience of death as man's destiny, if accepted with an opened and unarmored heart, acquaints us with a dimension of existence which fosters a detachment from the immediate aims of practical life. Now, as always, the philosophical mind will react with awe to the mystery of being revealed in a grain of matter or a human face. Of course, all such responses are not in themselves festivity. They are the postludes of festivity, but in the proper circumstances they could again become the preludes. All such modes of ascending out of the world of mere utility once arose from the soil of a festival, perhaps long since faded or forgotten. And so they may, by virtue of their evocative power, once again become a step toward a new festival to be celebrated in the future. Consequently, for the sake of what prospects there are for true festivity in our time, it is essential to resist the sophistical corruption of the arts, the cheapening of eroticism, the degradation of death, as well as the tendency to make philosophy a textbook subject or an irresponsible juggling of big words. The core and source of festivity itself remains inviolably present in the midst of society. This is as true today as it was 1,000 years ago. It remains in the form of the praise given in ritual worship, which is literally performed at every hour of the day. By its nature, that praise is a public act, a festival celebrated before the face of creation, whether its site is a catacomb or a prisoner's cell. And because the festive occasion, pure and simple, the divine guarantee of the world and of human salvation, exists and remains true continuously, we may say that in essence one single everlasting festival is being celebrated, so that the distinction between holiday and workday appears to be quite erased. But both the all-embracing publicness of the religious festival and the continuous presence of that festival remain veiled from empirical observation. In happier ages, the hidden element manifested itself in visible form in the great feast days on which the passage of workaday utilitarian time came to a halt for a moment. In less fortunate periods, in which even rare holidays come to nothing for a great variety of reasons, festivity recedes to deeper concealment. But what is hidden is nonetheless real, and those who are certain that the ever-bountiful source of all festive celebration remains unalterably present in the world, even though veiled, will regard the empirically patent unfestivity of this same world as not altogether hopeless. However, they will see it as a condition that is difficult to decipher, and above all, that is in suspense. Two extreme historical potentialities may have equal chances. The latent everlasting festival may be made manifest, or the anti-festival may develop in its most radical form. The Christian, however, is convinced that no destructive action, no matter how thoroughgoing, even if it is fervently celebrated as a gruesome anti-festival, can ever corrode the substance of creation. Miraculously founded and miraculously restored, it cannot be corrupted by the will to nothingness. Thus there always remains the festive occasion, which alone justifies and inspires celebration. It remains in force, forever undiminished, and not even the complete success of self-annihilation on the part of the human race, not even the complete destruction of the earth, could stamp out true festival. To be sure, in that case it would be celebrated not in this eon nor on earth. But basically this is true, as we have seen, even for the festivals we celebrate here and now, in this present historical time. Such thoughts lead, of course, far beyond a philosophical study of festivity, and we have reached a boundary at which the philosophical mind must necessarily fall silent. But it would be no very exceptional case if this silence made it possible to hear a more than philosophical message. The end.